This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
And I'd like to invite another change of personnel, but Martin again will be around if you wanted to ask questions in this next session. We can get the microphone to Sir Martin as well. And I'd like to invite up onto the stage our panel for the Ensuring Access and Partnerships with Schools debate. They are Liam Owens, Head of Student Recruitment at Edge Hill University, Simon Liebus, Group Chief Executive of Cambridge Assessment. Simon, you're on this side. There we are. And Dr. Graham Atherton, Executive Director of AIM Higher, London West Central and North Partnership. So, as I say, the topic is about access and partnerships with schools. Pretty much the same sort of rules as we had before. So a couple of minutes each of introduction from our panellists and then over to you for questions. And I will take them in the order I just announced. So we'll start, please, with Liam Owens.
Thank you. Just want to be clear that I'm speaking on behalf of HALOA, not on behalf of my institution. And I think it's probably worth just saying a word or two about what HALOA is, because normally when you say to a room full of people like this, HALOA, they think there's something wrong with you. Like you can't speak properly.
Some sort of Hawaiian greeting.
Yeah. HALOA does stand for something. It's the Higher Education Liaison Officers Association. And we're a membership-led association. We've got over 800 members who work in 142 different institutions right across the UK. We were founded in 1990, and we operate in 9 groups. So there's a national kind of structure in terms of representative voice, but then there's also 9 groups where sort of intense activity, training, networking happens. There's a Wales group, Scotland group, North West, Northern Ireland is a group, North East, the Midlands, South East, South West, Anglia, and London each have their own separate groups. Like I say, members come together for sort of training, networking, professional development opportunities. Members typically operate in kind of education liaison, school liaison, outreach, WP, sometimes admissions, often marketing type remits. And what I think is really good about our association, it's got a really strong focus on regionality because it operates in those 9 groups. These are frontline people working with schools and colleges that understand exactly what's happening on the ground in their areas, whether it be in their towns or cities or within a wider area. Because they're the people working in schools and colleges every day, having the dialogue with teachers and having the dialogue with other organisations that have a kind of focus on career and access type responsibilities. So they really do have a good understanding of what's going on, a good grip of what the challenges are on the ground. They also work collaboratively together. So, for example, you might find that there are groups who run region-wide events for teachers, careers advisors, as an example. So a lot of collaboration, sharing best practice, and working together. Our purpose, really, in terms of why we do what we do, it's really about promoting entry to all sectors of higher education. We're particularly concerned about the nature and the quality of advice and guidance given either directly or indirectly to potential students and making sure that that's good, that's impartial, that it's accurate, and that it's effective. But also making sure that our membership are fully trained, that they know what's happening in terms of changes and that they're giving good information, advice and guidance as well. Just a couple of opening points. In terms of the challenges ahead, access to good information, advice and guidance is going to be a big challenge, I think, over the next couple of years. The scaling back of connections is giving particular cause for concern. And the introduction of an all-age career service as a kind of replacement for connections, I think, has lots of merit. But there was a piece in the Guardian education supplement yesterday, I don't know whether anybody saw that, really highlighting concerns over the funding of that all-age career service. And it's jointly funded by BIS and DfE. And BIS have come out and said £82 million, which already ring-fenced, is there and is available. But DfE, rather than the £203 million that they've been spending on connections, are talking about figures around £7 to £10 million. So how that all-age career service is going to be funded, I think, is a concern. Now, there's probably more from the Department for Education to say about that, but at the moment I think it's very conspicuous by an absence of figures in terms of how that's going to be funded. And I think we just need to be careful that the line of school autonomy and saying to schools you have responsibility for delivering the service that you think is best, we've got to make sure that that's not a sort of way of removing funding for delivering that type of all-age career service. I think the end of AIM Higher funding is also also of concern for us, the changes to EMA and changes to the Travel to Learn Fund are also things that are going to impact on how students are progressing, how they're getting information, advice and guidance. I think in some regions, lots of AIM Higher type activity is going to keep happening. And in some universities, they're bringing forward or moving their WP staff into their mainstream school liaison areas. And I think that's a good indication that activity will continue. But I think in some regions, that's not clear. Because universities also have their own funding pressures in terms of how they're going to keep their school liaison front-facing engagement with schools going. And there's been at least one university in the last fortnight who have written to our association to say we're not going to be members anymore because we're making all school liaison staff redundant. So I don't know how they're going to keep that front-facing IAG activity going under these funding pressures. And there's also some challenges with how we as a sector present ourselves to potential students. UCAS run a series of very good higher education fairs. They run across the country. They run throughout the year. It gives universities direct access to 250,000 plus students every year who are interested in making higher education choices. But there's some challenges in terms of how those events are going to be funded in the long term. So we've got lots of challenges ahead in terms of making sure that people are getting access to good information, advice and guidance. The final point that I want to make is there is lots of information available. There's lots of good ideas for how to make more information available. And I think the sector is very good at information and advice. I think the sector is probably less good at guidance, but I think the key point is that information, advice and guidance is essentially a passive thing, and having it available is all good and well. It's only effective if it's acted upon, if young people are engaging with it, listening, learning and making decisions based on sound information, advice and guidance.
Thank you very much, Liam. Simon Leibus.
Yes, I should just explain, I'm speaking on behalf of Cambridge Assessment, which is the department of the University of Cambridge, which owns its three exam boards, which are OCR, Cambridge International Exams and Cambridge ESOL. And our interest in access, therefore, focuses especially on the importance of articulation between HE and secondary and further education. And in that respect, there are three particular areas I would like to focus on. The first of them is this issue Martin Harris raised of decisions early on in a school career affecting and impacting people's choices when they come to go to university. And we did some interesting research a couple of years ago talking to 6,500 students from 60 different schools and colleges as to where they got their advice. And it was still the case that most of them, 43% of the students in the survey, said that they got advice from their parents, and teachers were the second source with about 38% of students, though interestingly the most valued source of advice was university admissions tutors and the internet. So there's quite a disparity there, but in terms of formal advice mechanisms, a lot of it's still down to informal contacts and people actually making their own decisions and taking own individual initiatives rather than responding to some of the institutional arrangements that are in place. And also, I think, importantly, we highlighted some quite considerable differences related to social class. For example, children of higher professionals receive more advice than their counterparts in other social class groups, and the children that received the least advice were those from what we call the routine professions of manual workers. So still some quite considerable disparities, notwithstanding the amount of effort that's been put into that. And it was good to hear Martin Harris saying that this is an area that's going to be highlighted. I think the second thing we have said many times as an awarding body is that we'd like to see much more HE involvement in what goes on in secondary schooling, in secondary schooling and FE, in terms of curriculum development, in terms of the formulation of A-level syllabuses and so on. But one of the factors that discourages that is that there's a lack of any institutional incentive for HE to collaborate in that way. And I think there needs to be career progression recognition. Maybe the REF rep needs to recognise people who are involved in helping awarding bodies develop syllabuses, working with schools on their curricula. And I think this is also very important in terms of some of the sorts of skill sets that students coming in from school to the HE system have. And again, we've just done some research and we found that 94% of first-year students felt that secondary education could have prepared them much better for the academic rigour of university. And that's a staggeringly high figure, I think. And also that 50% of first years felt that they lacked the necessary independent research and study skills. And 37% of the sixth formers we talked to said that they didn't have the necessary essay writing skills. And I think if one again comes back to some of the discussion about retention, these figures have actually some very great significance for how retention policies operate. And I think there needs to be much more focus on how we can better prepare young people for what is quite a traumatic transition. And again, I would make the plea that a much greater degree of HE involvement in what goes on in the schooling system actually would be very productive. And again, just looking at this in crude financial terms, we've talked about the impact of fees on student uptake. But if one looked at it in very crude terms, if you've got that 94% of students feeling they're badly prepared, they're going to be spending 3 to 6 months of that first year getting to grips with this new environment. And that's a cost to them of about £4,500. And I think in terms of how this whole situation unfolds and people's readiness to take on the debts represented by HE, they need to feel they're getting a good experience and that the progression is being made easy for them. And I think there's still a lot to do in that area. And that brings me perhaps to my final point, which is to do with the amount of resource that's devoted to the admissions process. And as numbers have escalated over the last 10 or 15 years, the investment in admissions processing and the apparatus to support admissions has virtually halved. And as a result, I think a lot of it now is much more mechanistic than it used to be. It relies much more crudely on public exam results without taking other factors into account. And again, I think this is something where there needs to be much greater investment in holistic admissions processes, both for reasons of equity and access, but also I think just in terms of making sure that students end up in the right places, because ultimately people's willingness to pay much higher fees for their higher education is going to depend on good experiences. And coming back to the figures I started with, about 43% of people getting most of their advice from parents and from families. Actually, the best recommendation for an individual institution is somebody's brother or sister saying, I went there and I had a great time, or somebody's friend saying that. And I think investing in the sort of differentiation that will allow institutions to offer that is going to be a very, very important part of how we sort of go forward.
Thank you. And Simon, presumably that research people can access, they want more details on that on the Cambridge Assessment website?
Yes, they can, yes, indeed.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Graham Atherton.
I'm just going to speak briefly about the post-AIM Higher landscape in terms of outreach and access to HE, and a little bit briefly about some of the work that is going on in London to take this work forward after AIM Higher. I think some of the big challenges after the end of AIM Higher, particularly, are going to pick up on, like Liam mentioned earlier on, is within skills. AIM Higher provided over 4,000 named contact persons in schools and colleges across England. And it's very uncertain whether that will continue post this July. So we're looking at an issue, particularly of working in terms of delivering outreach of schools, where there will not be people to work with and people to deal with. And that's going to be actually a major challenge, particularly how HEIs then go to deliver their access agreements, which, again, I meant many HEIs are looking at these new access agreements and seeing this as a challenging thing, having to meet new criteria, and particularly having to prove the impact of the outreach work they are doing. I think what this challenge, how we answer this challenge, is picking up on Martin's point, is around collaboration. I think, particularly at pre-16, we have to look carefully, HEIs look very carefully at the rationale for offering competitive services to schools where there is nobody there to link with and there isn't a capacity to deal with these issues. One can talk about the pupil premium as replacing AIM Higher or allowing this to happen in schools. It's a complete misnomer. Speak to those in schools, you see they're facing an overall cut in funding, alongside, of course, reductions in connections and other uncertainty in careers, where indeed they did provide any support anyway, which was always patchy across the country. I think collaboration with HEI is absolutely crucial. I think post-AIM Higher, that is differentiated across the country. In London, we have formed a new organisation called Access HE, which is a pan-London HEI-led organisation to enable collaboration to help universities deliver their outreach access commitments. 28 universities in London, HEIs in London, sorry, have agreed in principle to do some of their outreach work collaboratively, as well as doing much of it individually. We will hopefully be enabling in London through this new organisation, provide an impartial route for information on HEI's activities, on their courses, on the costs of their courses, and an efficient way of providing information, providing links to schools across the London area, as well as a number of joint events for schools, for staff, and for young people as well, and as well as a data evaluation service to provide HEIs with evidence of impact, as well as a number of other things we hope to enable universities to do across London, which is to look at the issue of transition and supporting that more efficiently, and to try and cope with the different challenges the different sizes of institutions face. This service will, over the next year, be hopefully funded by contributions from the universities. And I have been round in post-AIM Hire like an access salesman, unashamedly so, going round to universities trying to put to them the values and virtues of collaboration. And in London, of course, uniquely positioned with so many HEIs, that has so far proved, like what could be, hopefully something to take the work of AIM Hire and take outreach forward. But not only that, I mean, I've also had quite a number of conversations with universities outside of London about how they can collaborate with Access HE in London and think about collaborating with each other. I mean, talking to my colleagues across the country, it seems to be tentative reaches towards collaboration, but fear in this area as well, what this means in a competitive environment. But I re-emphasise that in efficiency terms for HEIs, looking at competing to provide outreach offers to schools at pre-16, bombarding schools with offers of activities, is going to look quite difficult to do when you indeed also have limited resources. All I would say finally is that, you know, we obviously, having worked in AIM Hire for a long time, and many of my colleagues, a different event yesterday, came from much more an access background. And of course, in many colleagues there, will they continue? Will their work continue? Much doubt and uncertainty about this. But if that work has to continue, it must be collaboration. And I think it's for the HEIs perhaps to lead on that collaboration, to accepting the fact that the position in schools is rather different. So in terms of London, we will continue to try and collaborate, and our doors are open. We will try and hope to collaborate with others outside of London as well. And if people want to collaborate and think about how to take outreach forward in a collaborative way, then contact us or speak to us, and we'll try and work together.
Thank you very much, Graham. Very timely advice, really, because it's not very long, is it, before AIM Hire funding comes to an end. Okay, we have questions. Again, we've got the roving microphone. I know we are running a little bit late. Don't worry, we'll give you a little bit of extra time in the coffee break, and we'll catch up before the end of the day, so don't worry too much about that. So, who would like to start me off? Do you want my questions, or do you just want to get a coffee? No. Well, I've got one I just would like to ask, just while you have a moment to think, because I'd just like to ask Simon, picking up on the point about, you know, academics getting more involved in issues about the school curriculum, school qualifications. How much evidence is there? I know government wants that. How much evidence is that the academics are, to put it bluntly, really wanting to get their hands dirty with that sort of thing and get down into schools? And if they do, what's the chance of them actually ever agreeing on anything?
Securing agreement in this sort of context is always a bit tricky, yes. But we have had experience when we developed the Cambridge Pre-U. We worked quite closely with a number of academics from the HE sector, and I think that's contributed to the success that we had in launching it. But I think more generally, if one's trying to achieve a systematic degree of involvement by HE in the development of secondary school curricula, there do need to be some supporting institutional arrangements, because otherwise I think you're very sort of subject to the Lone Ranger enthusiast, as it were. Yeah. And I think the sorts of things that I was talking about in terms of a career recognition for academics who are doing this, some sort of recognition in the REF, something in terms of the sort of hefty fund inspection arrangements and so on, QAA inspection arrangements, I think all these things could be used to try and stimulate a much greater and more systematic degree of HE involvement. And I think that would be a very positive thing, both in terms of what I was talking about, in terms of making sure that people progress through to HE with the right sorts of skill sets, but also one of the standard sort of debates we hear when everybody's not terribly boiled up about fees and all the rest of it is all about exam standards. And you hear a lot of complaints from HE that people don't have the writing skills, they don't have the knowledge and so on. And actually, it would be much easier for us as an awarding body to do the job of preserving standards if HE were involved in a systematic and proactive way with us in that.
Mm. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, yeah, question just at the back there, thanks.
Hello, the question is perhaps to Martin and to the speakers as well. Both yourselves and Nicola, in fact, have spoken about the need to get the message across, that the real issue is that the 9K sticker price that people see is having a real impact on how people think about, you know, whether or not to go to university. Surely this provides a really good opportunity to take advantage of the fact that we have this problem with perception and do something about it. So perhaps could I ask the panellists, what do you think we should do about this?
Okay. What should we do about the perception about the price of going to university? Liam?
I'd start with a sort of summary of the campaign that Biz, supported by UUK, are about to start running. In fact, have started this week to try and get the message across to potential students. And that campaign is twofold. It's a sort of online social media type campaign for aimed at students, and there's a radio campaign aimed at parents, and there's some Channel 4 stuff going on as well, just to try and start getting that message across to students about how the system works and dispel the myths. One of the key things is the budget for this campaign is a fraction of the price that was allocated to the 2006 campaign, and in some ways not all of that 2006 money was spent wisely, but this budget is much smaller. There's also some really interesting research that have come out from the Biz stakeholder group about the sorts of language that we use to describe this system and the sort of terms that people respond to. And parents particularly don't respond to the term disadvantaged or, if you're seen as poor, they'd rather you just use the word poor. Students absolutely do not run with the idea of the word investment in terms of higher education. Investment of time, yes, but investment of money, absolutely bond with them as a way of describing their contribution to HE. So it's a hugely difficult challenge to start changing that perception. Hopefully this campaign will start to get the message public, because at the moment it's been a lot of universities talking to themselves and stakeholders. So hopefully the national coverage will help. The stuff in the press yesterday didn't help. I think that sets the debate back a long, long way. And in terms of the £9,000 sticker price, I think that's potentially got a big problem if people start if people start behaving in a kind of Veblen type way where they start associating cost with quality, then I think we've got a problem.
And Graham?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Biz campaign, if done correctly, of course, cannot be harmful, but I think if ever, going back to my earlier points, there's a virtue in collaboration, it would be in this area, because effectively looking at the price of HE and where it's clustered, you've all got a joint interest really in presenting this message correctly. I think that, marketing campaigns, yeah, I mean, obviously with the messages appropriate for young people are beneficial. But at the same time, I think that the way really to communicate this message is actually a more face-to-face way, working in the schools and colleges where young people actually are. And I think that sort of work is the work where there is room for collaboration and room to ensure that you maintain your links you have with those groups. Because also evidence shows that a lot of young people, I mean, again, yesterday, the headline about is harmful around the quotas and non-quotas, etc. Yeah, harmful to people in this room. You know, I'll go come to some sixth forms down the road and find out how many of those young people actually were aware of this yesterday. I'll bet you not many. So there'll be other ways of working with these young people, and again, marketing being one of them, but again, rebuilding and working with them face-to-face. And this, again, cannot be happened just now, and it won't happen overnight, but it's the sort of thing that has to happen if we're really going to get this message across.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think time's slightly against us, so I'm going to take a unilateral decision to sort of bring this to an end. We are running slightly over, really, because we started till 10 or 15 minutes late. Don't worry, we will catch it up. And also, you've done well, because this is the longest session of the day, so I know it's been a long wait for your coffee, so I'm sure you're ready for that now. What I know we were previously saying back in here for 12, but I think if we say back here by sort of about 10, quarter past 12, I would urge you to run up and down the stairs, but health and safety would forbid me from saying that. But could we just finish with our show of appreciation to all of our panellists and all of our speakers this morning. Thank you. Thanks very much.